It's a big night for college football in the last night of the season. The regular season ended a month ago, and finally Auburn and Oregon play in the national championship game. NPR's Tom Goldman is with us from Scottsdale, Arizona, near the site of the game, which will be played in Glendale. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Steve. How are you?
I'm doing okay, thanks. Let's just review here. This is the, correct me if I'm wrong, is it the 88th or 89th bowl game of the season? But this is the one for the title.
I thought it was in triple figures,
no,
but yeah, it's the biggie.
And so how good is this matchup going to be?
Super good, Steve, if I can say that. There is a huge demand for tickets. Get this. I know a guy who put 4 tickets up for sale online as a joke for $80,000, mm-hmm. and he got a call from someone who was interested. But then he said no because he found 4 for $48,000. It's crazy money being tossed around. Prices for individual tickets reportedly as high as $15,000. Another indication of the madness, the judicial system in Alabama, where Auburn is located, is delaying cases so people can watch the game. And an indicted casino owner charged with bribing Alabama politicians, he got a 72-hour pass to come to Arizona to watch the game.
Well, you know, if you've already got your tickets, you've got to be able to use them. The judge is going to be sympathetic.
That's right, even if you're indicted, exactly.
Now, Auburn has not won a national title in more than 50 years. Oregon has not won. What makes this game so special?
Well, just that. These guys are a couple of fresh faces on the mega stage. Neither has played in the BCS championship game since it went to this number one versus number two format in 1998. They are both undefeated with explosive offenses. Oregon scores over 49 points a game. Auburn scores about 43 points a game. They have exciting individual players. We've all heard of Cam Newton, the high Heisman Trophy winning quarterback, 6'6", 250. He's bigger than most Oregon defenders. And, you know, of course, there's this curiosity factor about Newton and the scandal that dogged him all season when the NCAA ruled he's eligible to play tonight because the NCAA said he didn't know his dad was shopping him around when Cam was being recruited at Mississippi State. Some don't believe he didn't know, mostly Oregon fans, and they wish he wasn't eligible for the game.
I guess you're one of those Oregon fans.
Busted, okay? I'm an Oregon alum, Steve. I will have you know, however, that I am not letting that affect my job. In fact, a Duck fan who's a friend, he berated me for not accepting a quacker. That's a kazoo in the shape of a duck bill that makes quacking noise, and I won't make that now. He said I should have one in the press box. I told him I have my ethics.
But now what about Auburn? I mean, I assume you're going to pay attention to the other team here. What has really made them so successful?
Well, Cam Newton has made them successful, and they've got a great defense, a great defensive line headed by a defensive tackle named Nick Fairley. He's an All-American. A very good team, but you got to put it squarely on the shoulders of Cam Newton. They wouldn't be the same team without him.
So how will the Ducks compete?
Well, they're not going to stop Newton. What they would like to do is pressure him with their defensive line. Oregon doesn't want him to get comfortable and set up his ability to pass or pick out running lanes. And that's a big challenge for Oregon because Auburn has a massive offensive line. The players average 304 pounds. It's hard to push them around.
Okay, so Auburn's got some big guys, but Oregon's got the quackers. You blow the quackers at them a couple times and they'll have nothing left.
Yeah, it'll make them fall over, either that or the Ducks' speed, because the Ducks have this hurry-up offense that leaves opponents gassed. They're the fastest team in the nation, and Auburn just is going to try and prevent them from running past them.
Tom, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
That's NPR sports correspondent Tom Goldman covering tonight's national championship college football game. So that's one set of high-level meetings. Let's talk about another. The French president, Nicolas Sarkozy, is visiting President Obama today in Washington. The French leader would like to talk about money. In particular, he wants to start a dialogue about reshaping the world monetary system. France is hosting the G8 and G20 summits of leading industrial nations later this year, and Sarkozy would like to reduce the role of the U.S. dollar as the world's primary reserve currency. Eleanor Beardsley reports from Paris.
The New Year's Eve address by the president is always a big deal in France. This year, Sarkozy said the economic crisis meant hosting the G8 and G20 summits was a huge responsibility. France, he said, would strive to build a more regulated, less brutal world. And he said there must be radical changes.
Le système mis en place en 1945 reposait sur l'échange fixe.
The system put in place in 1945 is for a world that doesn't exist anymore. Today we have flexible exchange rates and new currencies. What's the sense of a model based on the accumulation of dollar reserves? It's simply unstable and makes part of the world dependent on American monetary policy.
Sarkozy's idea to stop the U.S. dollar from being the primary reserve currency would reflect the new reality of a more multipolar world and the rise of new powers like India, Brazil, and China. In the United States, the talk is all about China's undervalued currency, but much of the rest of the world is also affected by the weak dollar, says Philippe Dessertine, head of Paris's High Finance Institute.
Une grande majorité des pays du monde ont le sentiment.
A large majority of countries feel that using the dollar as the only reserve currency is very dangerous. Just look at the Federal Reserve's latest actions, which favors the U.S. but has consequences for the rest of the world. Emerging countries in Europe really want to change that.
There's been international criticism of the Fed's latest efforts to stimulate the U.S. economy through quantitative easing, where dollars are printed to buy U.S. government bonds in order to increase the money supply. Dessertine says the glut of devalued dollars floods developing countries, pushing their currencies up, which quashes their exports and job creation. Dessertine and many other economists say the dollar will remain king for now if the world economy doesn't go into recession. But if things get worse, Dessertine says the U.S. will have to work with other nations to reduce the dollar's influence. Nicholas Dungan, a U.S.-based advisor with the French Institute of International and Strategic Relations, says America cannot control the international monetary system by itself, but the U.S. is still reluctant to surrender the dollar's dominant position.
What Sarkozy is proposing has some uniquely European and indeed some uniquely French aspects to it, particularly with respect to international financial regulation, trying to stabilize currency rates, trying to stabilize commodity prices. Those are not going to be the areas where the United States and indeed Obama is most receptive.
Sarkozy is hoping he will succeed in getting world leaders at least talking about a new monetary system. He already has the backing of the leaders of India and China. For NPR News, I'm Eleanor Beardsley in Paris.
And you hear Eleanor's reports right here on Morning Edition from NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. It's now time for All Tech Considered. Wikipedia, the free encyclopedia that anyone can edit, turns 10 this week. And if you've been on the site lately, you've seen a banner ad floating atop your search result that says, "Please read an urgent appeal from Wikipedia founder Jimmy Wales." It's a plea for donations because Wikipedia does not use advertising. Wikipedia recently reached its $16 million goal, and to tell us what that $16 million is for, here's the founder of Wikipedia, Jimmy Wales, who joins us from London. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
And first, what are you going to use the $16 million for?
Well, the money that we get goes to several different things. Primarily, it's to keep the site on the air. That's our first and most fundamental goal at the Wikimedia Foundation. So we have the servers and the bandwidth, the developers. We have the site administrators, the technical operations people who keep the site running. And then, of course, in the office, we have all of the normal functions of a nonprofit. But this year, we're actually engaging in some new projects. We're going to open our first office outside the U.S. in India to help further the growth of Wikipedia in the Indian languages.
The operation that you're running seems so huge, the number of entries that are out there and the number of people using it. Just feels like $16 million seems like an awfully slim sum. I mean, it's obviously a lot of money. It sounds rather little. You're actually doing. What is the actual budget of the operation?
Well, our annual budget for the coming year is $20.1 million. So we raised $16 million in the annual campaign. We have money that comes in throughout the year from small donors. We have some grants, some major donors. It is a small amount of money. I mean, it's really astounding what we've been able to do with such a small amount of money, but in part it's because of our nature as an online organization, as a really community-driven organization, where all of the things that you see on the website are really in the hands of the volunteers and all of their social structures and things like that. And the foundation's job is primarily to keep the site on the air.
If one could calculate the ratio of users of any outlet or publication in any medium, including the web, to the number of employees or budgeted dollars at that outlet, Wikipedia would have to have the highest ratio on Earth.
As far as I'm aware, what do you think it would be? Well, we have around 50 employees right now. We're going to hire a few more this year, and we have about 400 million visitors to the website every month. So, you know, each of the employees is responsible for about 8 million people. That's pretty amazing if you think about it.
Here's an example of Wikipedia in action and displaying a weakness. On Saturday, Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords was shot. And in a very unfortunate moment, NPR had two sources, as it turned out, two bad sources, saying that she died. At least two cable channels, CNN and Fox, said they confirmed our bad story. As we were getting it wrong, you were getting it wrong. Wikipedia was getting it wrong along, too. I could tell you who got it wrong here, but at Wikipedia, a contributor identified only as 138.47.108.25 got it wrong. Why does anyone can edit mean anyone can edit anonymously?
Well, I mean, in a case like this, of course, I don't think it shows a weakness in Wikipedia. I think we ran with the story for the same reason that lots of people did. And it was actually very interesting to look at the discussion and debate that emerged afterwards, detailing specifically, well, how should we handle this? What should we tell people and when and so forth? So it's quite an interesting community.
But in this community, for example, I read about one of the contributors who took part in the wiki edit of the Gabrielle Giffords entry. He's C.Fred. I know where he went to college, what he does for a living, that he's interested in the interstate highway system and the difference between Canadian football and U.S. football, but not his name. He doesn't sign with a name and take responsibility for his contribution. Why not?
Well, I mean, I think from our perspective, when we've looked at it, it really comes from a purely empirical question, which is to say, does it really make any difference? If I look at your work and I see you're doing really good work, knowing your actual name doesn't seem to really enhance anything or add anything to that. Now, if we did a look at everything and we saw that, gee, when people supply their real name, they do a really great job, and if they don't supply a real name, they do a really lousy job, obviously we would change things. But it doesn't seem to actually matter.
How many people are there who are contributing and editing items on Wikipedia?
Well, it's hard to really come up with a single number because some people are extremely active. They're on the website every day. This is the core community. Of those, there's a few thousand. Then there's a broader group of people who are semi-regular editors and you know, contribute from time to time. And we would say there's probably around 100,000 of those. And then there's a lot more people who just may make one or two edits every now and then. They see a little something wrong and they just chip in and help out.
Is there a profile of a contributor to Wikipedia that would pretty much describe the typical contributor or no such thing?
Yeah, we've done some user surveys to find out who's contributing to Wikipedia. The average age is around 26. We're about 85% male, which is something we'd like to change in the future.
85% male?
85% male. We think that's because of our tech geek roots, and I think it reflects a broader issue in society in many ways. But we're hoping, as we change the software to make it more accessible for more people to edit, that you shouldn't need to be a computer geek. We want to be welcoming to geeks who aren't computer geeks.
How would you describe your ambitions for the second 10 years of Wikipedia's existence?
Well, the main thing that we're focused on going forward is the expansion of Wikipedia into the languages of the developing world. When we look at the really large, really successful Wikipedia languages, they are essentially the European languages, Japanese and Chinese. And then beyond that, it falls off fairly quickly. And what we're really looking at is where are the places that we see a lot of activity that can be really supported and extended so that we can really fulfill the dream of Wikipedia, which is a free encyclopedia for every single person on the planet in their own language.
Are you all involved in apps and in access on mobile phones and the like and thinking that that's where the action is going to be for Wikipedia? Or like those of us who hang out in radio still, are you committed to the old-fashioned web?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Certainly we do want to be active in the apps world and make sure that on mobile devices that Wikipedia is as usable as possible because in particular in the developing world, we know that tons of people are going to come online for the first time via mobile devices. And so that's a really important component of things. On the other hand, I haven't decided yet if I'm just old-fashioned and wrong or if I'm right, but someone asked me recently, did you see the Wired magazine's big story about the web being dead. And I said, yeah, I did see it. I read it on the web. So we'll see.
Well, Jimmy Wales, good luck in the future at Wikipedia. And thanks for talking with us today.
All right, thanks.
So Jimmy Wales, the founder of Wikipedia, the site turns 10 years old on January 15th.
This is NPR.
William Trevor has been writing for over 50 years, and during that time, he's won more literary awards than we have time to list here. Trevor has published 14 novels, but he's even more celebrated for his short fiction. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review of his latest collection of stories.
At the risk of sounding like an old geezer, prematurely, I might add, I think that the idea of curling up on a large piece of upholstered furniture with my fur ball of a dog nestled beside me and a good story to read sounds like the ideal winter endurance strategy. If you're the seriously dormant type, too, I've got a book to recommend that packs so many good stories into one volume that if the demands of everyday life permit, you could stay safely socked away in your reading burrow till the first thaw. The book is the recently published second volume of William Trevor's collected stories. The writer, anointed by The New Yorker as the greatest living writer of short stories in the English language, and anointed by me as the hibernating bookworm's best friend. Trevor is a master of capturing those small shifts in consciousness that shatter someone's world. Because he's an Irishman living in exile, Trevor has lived most of his long life in England, and because so many of those aforementioned epiphanies take place oh so discreetly, the comparisons to James Joyce have been inevitable. But as the 48 recent stories in this volume attest, Trevor has a more developed taste for the macabre than Joyce ever did. It creeps up on a reader slowly. The awareness that so many of these tales are about being trapped, buried alive, thwarted at every turn of life's labyrinth. And yet, the signature response of Trevor's characters to their bricked-in situation is a fatalistic shrug, garnished with black Irish humor. The lead-off tale here is called The Piano Tuner's Wives, and the tidy first paragraph supplies the plot in miniature. Violet married the piano tuner when he was a young man. Belle married him when he was old. Belle, the 59-year-old second wife, was once the town beauty, smart in her clothes, who decades before was cast over by the piano tuner for her rival, Violet. Now Violet is in her grave, and Belle is in the marriage bed, and yet Violet still haunts their lives. Because the piano tuner is blind, he'd relied for decades on his first wife to be his eyes, so Belle literally hears her dead predecessor speaking through her husband's descriptions of the physical world. In the brilliant climax of the tale, Belle vindictively decides that if she can't banish her predecessor, she'll just banish the world Violet once inhabited. The Piano Tuner's Wives, like most of Trevor's stories, takes place in an Ireland that seems out of time. Most of Trevor's characters would have been right at home in the Ireland of the Celtic twilight, rather than the twilight of the Celtic tiger. In The Hill Bachelors, for instance, a young man named Paulie leaves his job in England to attend his father's funeral in rural Ireland. Silently, Paulie's four adult siblings conspire to appoint him the sacrificial lamb who'll stay on to help his aged mother run the isolated farm. The farming life Paulie passively agrees to could have been led by a character out of John Ford's 1950s classic about 1930s Ireland, The Quiet Man. In a spectacularly affecting story called After Rain, a young Irish woman named Harriet returns to an out-of-the-way Italian hotel that she'd stayed in as a child with her parents. Harriet is disappointed that the hotel is now overrun with tourists from the new Europe. She'd hoped to find refuge in the familiar, especially since a long-term romance has just fallen apart. In this turning point moment, which displays Trevor's eloquent precision, Harriet comes to realize the tragic trap of trying to recapture the past. This love affair had once, like the other affairs before it, felt like the exorcism of the disappointment that so drearily colored her life when her parents went their separate ways. Both parents said the separation was a happier outcome than staying together for the sake of the family. Her brother shrugged the disappointment off, but for Harriet, it did not begin to go away until the first of her love affairs. And always, when a love affair ended, there had been no exorcism after all. Trevor's outcasts never make obvious bids for our sympathy, but they elicit it nonetheless. The stories collected here also compose a quietly devastating argument for the beauty and power of the short story form as a tool for cutting to the quick of human desire and vulnerability.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed William Trevor's latest collection of short fiction called Selected Stories. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Joan Tui Westman, Sam Brigger, John Myers, John Sheehan, Lauren Krenzel, and Heidi Simon. I'm Terry Gross.
Now, tomorrow night, the satirical newspaper and website The Onion arrives in cable TV sports news. The Onion has turned its already popular online sports site into a half-hour show on Comedy Central, which spoofs the kind of coverage seen on ESPN. Here's NPR's Mike Pesca.
Good times are the enemy of good satire. Some despair over high unemployment, political vitriol, and entertainment culture that rewards louts and loons and birds falling from the sky. The Onion takes it as something of an apocalyptic opportunity.
Patriots head coach Bill Belichick has thrown acid in the face of his star quarterback, Tom Brady. Apparently, out of jealousy that Brady was handsome and loved, while he himself was a hideous monster.
This is The Onion Sports Dome, an offshoot of the satirical newspaper The Onion. The DNA of ESPN's Sports Center is so infused in the visual grammar of the Sports Dome that you could picture disoriented ESPN anchor John Buchagross wandering onto the wrong set one day and hosting the fake broadcast by mistake. The Sports Dome takes down not only the ridiculous excesses of the sports world, but the specific high-energy, high-fiving, high-decibel techno beat underscoring highlight packages that ESPN traffics in. Now, the Sports Dome's take is not for the easily offended, or even the moderately offended. Look, you're going to be offended. For instance, the premiere episode is scheduled to have a segment that's in terrible taste given recent events.
Let's go to the kill down. Major League Baseball, still a ton of productive players who can't find jobs, and we're hearing cries of collusion. Doc, who do you kill?
I kill Bud Selig. Ex-owner loves to watch the players get screwed high and low.
But the joke isn't, wouldn't it be funny to kill Bud Selig or the entire offensive line of the Oakland Raiders, which is also proposed. It's the hyperbolic lack of perspective that characterizes the sports media. The sports talk radio show I listen to, for instance, poses hypotheticals this way. Gun to your head, who do you want as quarterback, Hasselbeck or Whitehurst? As if it would be impossible to consider the Seahawks' depth chart without an invitation to bodily harm. A lot of the Sports Dome's jokes go immediately to the very dark. And coupled with the energy of the production, I wonder if they'll be able to carve out the right space for a version of those great slice-of-life onion stories, like Area Man constantly mentioning he doesn't own a television. But the show excels in nailing the details. Take this clip where St. Louis Cardinals slugger Albert Pujols is offered a key to the city, a literal key, which would unlock the doors to every residence and business.
Full unlimited access to St. Louis. No questions asked.
Our homes, our cars, our internet access, our showers, and whatever's in our fridge. All of it is yours, Albert. The buffet is open.
The clip was supposedly taken from an outdoor press conference. Did you notice how the mic sounded different from the studio anchor who introduced the clip and how the public official's mic picked up the sound of traffic? I don't know if the Onion Sports Dome will find an audience which rests in the shared area of the Venn diagram containing sports and black comedy. But I predict that the day after the Sports Dome airs, it will be the talk of ESPN, with the consensus opinion being they've got us down pretty good, followed by... And has anyone seen John Buchagross? Mike Pesca, NPR News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.